Okay, thank you very much for the opportunity to give this talk. So I will talk about some work which we've done on using the unified modeling language in order to construct security critical systems. And also I will relate this work to the CORAS framework. So firstly, what is the problem? Well, as we've heard today already, there's a problem with computer security. So in a more general view, the situation is that our modern society increasingly relies on computer networks for all kinds of things related to its infrastructure, such as communication, finance, and so on. And the problem is that these networked computer systems are vulnerable to attack because the networks connecting them are open to general use, and of course the most famous network is the internet. And the problem then is that attacks can be launched against these networks from a safe distance and in an anonymous way. So this is the sort of new thing which, at least in the commercial setting, has only been around for a couple of years now. And that, well, it does create a lot of problems. As you may be aware, there are actually quite a lot of cases in the media where attacks were successfully placed against computing systems. I will give a couple of examples. But firstly, the relation to telemedicine. Of course, there the problem is particularly pressing because there we deal not only with potential loss of money because of loss of, say, credit card numbers or something, but more seriously, possibly also with the loss of life. So in the extreme case of telesurgery, which may be attacked. So in that case, our concern are the security requirements of availability and integrity, meaning that the system should provide the services that are necessary, and meaning that the functioning of the system should not be able to be corrupted by an adversary. But secondly, also maybe less drastically, but also I think quite important, is the issue of data protection of patient data. And so far this has mainly been medical data, but increasingly this will also be genetic data. For example, you may be aware that there is this pilot project in Iceland where currently I think almost all of the population of Iceland is all of their medical data is put into a central databases. And also with a view towards extending these databases with genetic data. And of course, this kind of data is of interest to different parties, including possible employers, but of course also insurance companies, because they are interested in all kinds of information that helps them compute the risks connected with selling a policy to a given person. And yeah, this is generally not seen to be acceptable, so far at least, in many or in most countries. But of course the question is whether there may be the possibility of information leaking through, which wasn't actually supposed to leak through. So yeah, there are some specific security issues in telemedicine, of which here I'm giving two. And the problem now is, as I mentioned, it's not so easy to design security critical systems correctly such that they are not able to be attacked. And there are quite spectacular examples, and one of them I'm giving here, although it's already rather old. But because it's really quite drastic, in that example it was shown that it is in fact, or it would have been possible, to this hacker team from the National Security Agency in the US to break into the military computers and also the electric power system, and to they would have been able to provoke power outages and emergency call overloads in Washington DC. So this is really more than just losing your credit card number. And yeah, now the question is, why does this happen? And here I'm focusing on the technological side. And of course, we've heard in previous talks that, of course, it is important to not only view that, but also to look at the human interaction side. And I perfectly agree with that. But yeah, in the current work that I'm presenting here, we focus on the technological side. And the problem there is that it is simply not so easy to design secure systems correctly, because the requirements that are important there are simply complicated. It's not as in, for example, in the safety case, where one would say that accidents should not happen too often, and where one would usually assume that accidents happen randomly and without intent. But in security, it's just the other way around. We have to be aware of adversaries that are actually, well, that set out to attack the system and can think of all kinds of things in order to succeed at that. And yeah, so the thing is complicated in itself. And moreover, it is so far not often the case that the developers actually have an educational background in security, because until recently, security was really more of a military issue and was not so widely talked at universities. And also, it's often the case that companies who develop systems from the outset don't, firstly, don't think about security at all, because what they're concerned of in the beginning is to create a product and to do this as quickly as possible, to be the first to be able to sell the product. And then later they may think that one should also worry about security, but then it's usually not easy to add security in retrospective. Some examples even show that even for experts, it's not so easy to design security mechanisms correctly. And there are one example which is quite famous in the computer security community, which was a so-called authentication protocol, which is a security mechanism developed in 1978 by two of the main experts in the field. And there were two attacks found later against this protocol, one 3 years later and another one 17 years later after the publication of the protocol. And I guess this shows that it's really a difficult issue in itself. But secondly, also a second kind of causes for the problems is that you cannot just insert security into your system, for example, by saying that, I'm using SSL to encrypt my network traffic, therefore my system is secure, which is often believed and also often used as an argument by e-commerce companies put on their website saying, you can give us your sensitive data because we use SSL, and therefore it will be secure. But this is not the whole story. So of course, this only secures the communication, and we don't know how secure the data is stored at the actual company. And the second thing is that you always have to worry about the actual system context that your system is used in. And many of the problems that do arise are caused by the fact that a system is developed under certain assumptions, and then maybe sometime later it is used in a different environment, because people are simply not aware that there were certain assumptions made, and they just have the system and they want to use it, and that may create a problem. And yeah, there's this citation by also two of the experts in the field who also make this statement that it's not sufficient just to put in some security technology such as cryptography and then assume that therefore your system is secure. So it's not as easy as that. And the specific difficulties in the security case, as opposed to worrying about usual accidents in computer systems, is that once your system is broken, you have to be aware that it's quite possible that the information will be spread out, maybe over the internet. So a famous example for this is the case of those script kiddies that download scripts from websites, which enables them to hack into other websites without actually knowing exactly how this works. So this kind of thing in the last few years became very, very much of an easy thing to do, whereas previously, when this information was not simply published, you really had to know something about hacking into websites in order to be able to do it. But now you can just do it very easily. And the second thing, specific to security, as opposed to making sure that software in other contexts is running correctly, is that the developers of security critical systems often don't get feedback from the customers. They just don't know if the system they developed actually is secure in practice, because the customers are just too sensitive about the whole issue. They would rather not blame you for any mistakes and pay for any possible damage themselves, rather than having to suffer from bad media attention. For example, banks would really suffer from that. And so the developers really work in some kind of dark environment where they don't know what the impact of what they're doing. And so the approach that dealt with this whole issue mainly in the past was that of penetrate and patch, where the idea was I develop my system and then I release it, and if something happens, then I just come up with a fix and distribute it to the customers, and then this problem will be solved, this specific problem. But as one can guess, that's not very secure because of the lag between someone else finding the flaw and you being aware of this mistake. Because this someone may not be so honest to tell you in the first instance, but make use of the weakness, and you don't know how much damage is caused until you can actually remove this problem. And secondly, also the whole process in itself, even if it works, it's not very ideal, because you the simple fact of distributing these patches, it destroys confidence in your customers, who will not really believe that after the patch the system will actually be secure. And also it costs money, and it's just an annoyance to people. So these kind of reasons have in the past already motivated a lot of research using formal methods in order to ensure that systems that are developed are actually correct and are therefore actually secure. But the problem with these formal methods is that they require quite some effort in training people in the first instance in order to use these formal specifications, and secondly also in the process of using formal methods, it's usually not easy to construct a formal specification which you would need in order to apply the usual formal models. And sort of reflecting on this past approaches, now the idea is that it would be good to have a system which is secure by design as opposed to secure after penetrating and patching it. And so the idea is to consider security within the development process actually, and not in retrospective, and to put this security awareness in the development context. And this idea has been around for quite some time. For example, there's a classical paper by Salz and Schröder from 75, which also promotes this view. But unfortunately, so far, it has not really been realized so much in practice, as I mentioned already. And the main reason for that is probably that the correctness or security of the system is always in conflict with the cost of developing it. These mentioned formal methods are usually not being used because they're simply too expensive in practice. So in order to deal with this problem, the idea is now to use a modeling language which is already used in industry, and therefore which at least decreases the cost of training people in using it, because people already know it. And also in the case of UML, it is the case that it is taught at universities rather widely these days. So one can assume that future generations of developers also know UML. And so this is the main advantage of UML, that it is in fact a de facto standard in industrial modeling. And also compared to earlier predecessors of this notation, it is relatively precisely defined. And saying relatively precisely means that in the actual specification document of UML, the meaning of the notation is only given in English language and not in a mathematical notation. So that is sort of the bound on the preciseness that we have in the document. But as I said, compared to other notations which have that kind of size of user community, this is already rather precise. And also another advantage is that there are quite a few tools which exist already, for example, a lot of drawing tools, or which are in development, for example, tools that give more in-depth analysis of UML specifications. And I will say a little bit more about such tools. So what is UML? I mean, we have heard already quite a bit about this in earlier talks today. So just to recapitulate, it's a visual language to model object-oriented systems in the first place, or component-oriented systems more generally. And this notation, one of the advantages is that it allows different views on the system that is being developed, including the the physical view of the system, and also the structural view or the behavior of the system. Is there a problem?
Yeah.
Maybe?
You were talking about design focus earlier
on. Oh, I see.
Yeah, but still, I didn't know that. We managed to get most of it, so I think you should just continue.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Another advantage of UML is that it allows a relatively high degree of abstraction. So using these different diagrams allows you to specify the system firstly without giving too much detail. And then in a second step, you can go down and give more detail on the system. And this has the advantage that you can find certain errors already relatively early in the development cycle. And the point is that the earlier you find mistakes, the less expensive it is to fix them. And that's also one of the advantages of UML. And lastly, important advantage of UML relevant to this work I'm presenting here is that it has already standard extension mechanisms, meaning that you can adapt this notation to your specific modeling domain. And for example, what I'm looking at here is, of course, security critical systems. So these extension mechanisms allow you to conveniently express security relevant information in your system specification. But of course, you could do this with other things too. For example, there is already an extension of UML for real-time systems. So that's quite a good feature of this language. So how does this notation look like now? I assume that most of you have seen it already, so I don't really have the time to give a really in-depth introduction. But just to get a general idea, it consists of various kinds of diagrams, I will explain some of them in more detail on the next couple of slides. And for those of you who actually know UML, I will just mention what kind of diagrams I'm using in this approach. So on the whole, the UML is quite a big and complicated language. So if one wants to make use of it in a way that allows for mechanical processing of the diagrams, then it's probably a good idea to choose a fragment of the UML which is simplified in a way that makes this processing easier. And what I'm using here in this work is a fragment consisting of simple versions of activity diagrams, class diagrams, sequence diagrams, state chart diagrams, deployment diagrams, and finally the package mechanisms of UML, which allows to group diagrams together. Some of them I will explain in more detail on the next slides. But firstly, I come back to this extension mechanism of UML that I mentioned. And the way this works is that within these diagrams that we use to model systems in UML, you can attach certain labels which are of this form, that they are enclosed in angle brackets, and these you can also define yourself. So and this is what I'm making extensive use of in this work for using UML for security. For example, you could create the label secrecy and use that label to label parts of the system, or for example data, which should be kept secret, and therefore you should pay special attention to when you analyze the UML specification. So for this, these labels are quite useful, and moreover, you can extend these labels with so-called tagged values, which are simply pairs of tags and values. So tags are just another kind of label, and values can be any kind of value that is that you define the tag to be. And we also see an example of that on the next couple of slides. So for example, you could say secrecy equals, and then a list of variables in your system that should be kept secret. So that would be a way of making use of this mechanism. And thirdly, you can use constraints within this notation in order to formulate conditions that the system specification should fulfill in order for this stereotype to be valid in your diagram. And this you can then also use in the security analysis of your specification. So, now as I mentioned, we have been developing this extension of UML for secure systems development called UMLSec. And the idea is to find certain possible vulnerabilities of a system already in the design phase. Of course, you cannot find all of possible mistakes, because some will only arise when you implement the system. But the point is that there are examples which you would have found with this approach, and for these examples already it is useful to apply this approach. And secondly, this allows you to transport expert knowledge on security engineering to developers that may not be experts in security themselves, by making use of this notation and the extension by these labels. And yeah, as mentioned already, the idea is that this should make people consider security from early on in the system development. And as a side effect, often companies want to certify security critical systems that they are actually secure in a formal sense. And this is made more cost effective if you use this approach, because then you have part of the documentation already which you need for this these certifications. And so then how to define this extension of UML? This is the idea is here that certain security requirements, for example secrecy and integrity, are defined as stereotypes with tags, and these, as I mentioned already, you can then include in your system specification. And the associated constraints which are defined with these stereotypes, you can then use in the security analysis to find out if your system is secure in a precise sense. And so firstly, you can make sure that the security requirements that you include in your UML specification actually guarantee that the security policy that should hold on your system is actually realized. And secondly, you can then make sure that the behavior of your system, which is specified in the UML specification, actually also enforces these security requirements, which are stated as these stereotypes. And yeah, so this is just an idea how this profile may look like. So in the left column, one has a column with a number of stereotypes. Here, I only give an excerpt of the profile. So altogether, it's much larger. And yeah, some of these stereotypes I will shortly explain on the next couple of slides. So for example, there's the stereotype internet, which you can use to label links, communication links in your physical view of the system. And this of course means that the communication link is supposed to be an internet connection, and from that you derive certain information to be used in your security analysis. And so staying with this example, the information that you derive then you can actually make depend on the adversary model that you want to consider. So the idea is simply for a given type of adversary, you firstly have to determine what the adversary can do to a certain, for example, to a certain communication link or to a certain physical component. So in the case of internet link, as we know, it's not very difficult to eavesdrop on internet communication. And this means that, the technical way of representing this is by using this set of threads which arise from the stereotype. So whenever I have a communication link stereotyped internet, then one of the threads that arises from that is that the default adversary, so an adversary without special capabilities, is able to read the information that is going over this link. And also he's able to delete information on that link or to insert new information. And in the case of an encrypted internet communication link, the usual adversary is only able to delete information and not to read the information. And similarly, you can define these kind of threat scenarios for other physical links or components. And so these threat sets are then used as a formal basis for your security analysis, which you may make on your system specification. A second example for these stereotypes is that of secure dependency. So here the idea is that in these structural kind of diagrams within UML, you can specify which logical components of the system should be able to communicate with which other logical components. And this is done using these call and send. So this is done using connections between components which are labeled with call or send. And furthermore, you can label these communication connections again with security requirements, such as tag, such as high, meaning that this is a highly sensitive part of the system. And then the constraint, which is connected with the stereotype secure dependency, means that if a certain message in a logical component of the system is supposed to be highly sensitive, then it should only be possible to communicate it over communication links that are already also assumed to be highly sensitive. So that is one of these two conditions. And the other one is that whenever you compose two components with this high communication link, so this highly sensitive communication link, and one of them is a message that is supposed to be highly sensitive, then this message in the other component should also be considered highly sensitive. So so what is enforced by this requirement are relatively straightforward syntactic consistency checks on your UML specification. But this is already quite useful, because a lot of mistakes can already arise at that level. And also an advantage is that these kind of checks are relatively easy to implement, to check mechanically. An example for that would be in this very small part of the UML specification. So here you have two objects in the system. One of them should be able to call the other object through this interface. And here this security requirement is violated because on the one hand, this random generator is here supposed to be highly sensitive in the object that requests this information. But on the other side, the other part of the specification, which is not so easy to see here, it's not said that the information which is given by this random should be considered highly sensitive. So there's a mismatch between these two parts of the UML specification, and this means in this case that this requirement is violated. So as I said, it's a rather straightforward requirement. But there are more difficult things you can formulate with this approach. And an example for that is that of a secure information flow, meaning that assuming that you have certain data in your system that is supposed to be that is supposed to be highly sensitive, and assuming that other kinds of data is not sensitive, and now the situation may be that the highly sensitive data is only given to authorized sources, but the non-sensitive data is also accessible to participants that are not trusted in some way. And then, of course, it's important that there is no information leakage from the highly sensitive data to the the non-sensitive data. And this is what is enforced by this kind of condition. And in fact, this is a very difficult requirement, and there are actually quite a few amusing examples in practice where such a requirement was not fulfilled. So there's a classical example by Dorothy Denning from the 80s, I think, where she was able to, from publicly available data from the US Census, she was able to construct the salary of her boss, which was not supposed to be publicly available. And this is an example for this kind of information flow from from sensitive data to non-sensitive data. Yeah.
Just a small question. When you say data, do you really mean data? Or the anything that you can describe or specify? So, for example, would it be possible for somebody to observe the messages that are communicated without being able to observe the data?
Ah, okay.
This is a typical form
of attack. Yeah, that would also be an example for partial information flow.
Okay.
And so that's correct. Okay, so an example for that now, a bit closer to the aim of CORAS. And so this is supposed to be an example from the telemedicine area. And so suppose we have a medical database where different kind of data are stored, including the age of a patient. The way this diagram works here is now that firstly, when this database entry is created, we start with this black dot here, and then we come to a certain stage of the database entry. And then we can apply certain actions to the database, for example, by updating the entry. And this may mean that we remain in the same sort of state, or this may mean that we change to the other kind of state. And here the state, in this example, the state is characterized by the fact whether the patient is fit to be a blood donor or whether this is not the case. And then there are these operations here are supposed to mean, firstly, we can write the age of the patient to the database. And if it's the case that the patient is younger than 60 years, then he or she is eligible to be a blood donor. And if not, then it's not the case, and we go to the other state. And also, we have this operation read. This blood donor flag, where you can find out whether it's true or false that the patient could be a blood donor, and also it's possible to read the age. I think that's the relevant part of the diagram. Plus, also, we have this other. This other action, which is also important, namely write disease. So here the assumption is, if the patient has a certain disease, then he or she should not be a blood donor. And if that's the case, then we go to this state. Otherwise, we're in this state. And now the security requirement, which is formulated in the diagram, is that this information about the possible disease of the patient should be kept confidential. But on the other hand, it is not confidential whether or not the patient is fit to be a blood donor, and it's also not confidential the age of the patient, because that can be requested using this WA operation. And so this is why this specification also violates this information flow requirement, because there's some partial information leakage from the fact that, in certain cases, namely in the case when a patient is younger than 60 years and not, which I can find out, and then I can find out possibly that he or she is not fit to be a blood donor, and from that I can conclude that the patient has this disease, in this very simple example, of course. I mean, this is of course artificial, but just to illustrate the point. So this is an example which shows maybe that it's may not be so easy to enforce this kind of requirements. And it's now maybe very quickly, so the technical way of doing this kind of security analysis is then by performing a verification on the level of a formal meaning of these diagrams, and this has to be provided, or this is provided in our work, because as I mentioned already, in the original specification document, the meaning is relatively imprecise, or at least it's not possible to be automated directly. And this is also part of the work then. And yeah, the way this is being done is also a more technical question, which I cannot really explain in detail here now. And then the security analysis, of course, then has to take into account that there are adversaries who can do certain things, which I already mentioned, such as intercepting, modifying, deleting, or inserting messages. And another thing important here is that commonly we use cryptography to provide security, and this also has to be handled by the verification framework. And then the way this analysis is performed is that one models these classes of adversaries, for example, this mentioned default adversary, and then the system specification is, for example, could be simulated or even verified together with this adversary model. And this gives us then the security evaluation of the system specification. Yeah, and now, again, a bit relating to the CORAS framework, it would also be possible, and so this we haven't actually done yet, but instead of doing this security analysis on the previous slide, which is really a more qualitative thing, one could instead modify this adversary model by attaching probabilities to these actions like insert, read, delete, and so on. And also probabilities to certain events which may be important, for example, the compromise of a cryptographic key. And from that you could then derive probabilities for hazards, meaning for certain events which are meaningful for the use of the system rather than the technical execution of the system. And that would be some sort of risk analysis on a probability basis, or this would allow you to perform a risk analysis rather. And yeah, so the for this work to be useful, of course, you need tool support, and this is currently being done by taking a UML modeling tool and connecting it to a verification tool. But apart from that, there already exists an analysis tool which already has a UML-like notation, and this is the autofocus tool which is developed at Munich. So, conclusion, this UML extension, UMLSec, was developed to develop security critical systems. And here in this little example, I showed how to apply it to an example in the telemedicine area. And as I mentioned, the work in process considers tool support for this approach. And there are some resources for the whole issue. So for example, next Monday there will be a workshop in Dresden on using UML for critical systems development, including security critical systems. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I should perhaps mention that during the course presentation also at your workshop.
Yes, yes. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. But I have another comment, because also in the CODAS project we have developed the internet profile, and in connection with this I think that those who developed it were actually inspired by the work you have done at QM and together with BIML. When I look at your UML profile, I note that something. Do you have an asset stereotype in your language?
In order to say which parts of the system are important or are supposed to be kept.
Typically, when you do a risk assessment, the first thing you do is to identify your assets.
Mm-hmm.
And when we developed a UML language to support the CODAS methodology, the notion of assets was something that we found very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
throughout over diagrams, the assets they play a major role.
Mm-hmm. I guess I came from the other side of the from the more technical level, and there you would you could use things like the secrecy stereotypes in order to label data which is supposed to be secret, and that would be your asset. I can see the point when you come from the upper layer risk analysis view, then you would start with these assets. That's true. Yeah. So that would be a convenient thing.
Not only start with assets, you also need to assign values to these assets.
Mm-hmm.
That's your requirement in terms of what kind of loss you can afford with respect to these assets, and so on.
Yeah.
So for us, assets is very important.
Yes. Yeah, as I mentioned, the approach here is a more qualitative approach rather than quantitative. And that's why I don't have this assigning these values to things. But yeah, in that context, I see that this is important.
As a contrast, if you go to the safety world, you often only work with one asset, the human life, and the value is high. You don't need a separate value, and therefore, perhaps only the risk assessment for security that focus on that aspect, because it's inhabited in the safety risk assessment.
Mm-hmm.
It focuses on security.
But that could be a reason why it appeared in many research and new into methods and guidelines.
Let's not confuse things. The right answer to the comments previously is that the profile that you're producing is not about security assessment. It's about securing communication between the bodies.
Well, not only communication, but more about the technical level of secure systems. So it's not about risk assessment.
Yes, it is essentially about identifying security interactions, so to speak.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So both things can coexist. Mm-hmm. They can coexist naturally. It's not that there is something that is visible from the other. But this is my main question, and it has to do with the take-up of the whole thing. You mentioned a few times the lack of precise semantics of UML as a potential problem. What is the problem that this causes?
The situation is, I guess, similar to that of programming languages that also usually don't have a formal semantics, meaning that you can use them anyway, provided you have compilers, of course. The problem may be that two different compilers give you slightly different code for the same program. Here similarly, you could say, I don't care about formal semantics, I just take a UML tool and then I apply some kind of security analysis to the diagrams. But I think it's just cleaner if you firstly take the time to formulate something which is abstract and which, is sort of a mathematical notation for in which you then implement in your your UML tool, because then at least in theory, other people who want also want to build such a tool can look at your thing.
Let me rephrase the question. Mm. Does any part of what you just described, with the exception of the verification, assume the existence of any specific semantics for you?
No.
No. Okay. So that's fine.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.